to see so many people here today on these important issues. We will intend to have the public hearing on 2351, then House Bill 2969, then Senate Bill 2. We have invited testimony for House Bill 2351 this morning, and so I'm going to have the staff read the summary of the bill, and then we will go to our three panels.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 2351 enacts the Oregon Agricultural Labor Act. It creates the Oregon Agricultural Labor Board, declares state policy on agricultural labor. The bill permits agricultural employees to join labor organizations and to engage in collective bargaining. It establishes lawful activities and unfair labor practices. The bill permits courts to enjoin certain unfair labor practices and declares an emergency to become effective upon passage. And I should mention the bill has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Okay. Thank you very much. Call forward Piper Sweeney, Mark Simmons, Tim Bernasek. Good morning. We will intend to do 20 minutes per panel on this.
Great.
Good morning. My name is Piper Sweeney. I'm a grower from Dayton. I grow with my husband and his family on a third-generation farm. And I'm here in favor of Senate Bill 2351, or House Bill, because we grow broccoli. We have grown broccoli for 26 years, except for the exception of the past 2 years. And it's a labor-intensive crop that requires 40 to 50 people at the height of the summer. And because there are right now no rules that we operate under, that the union operates under, to where we feel we can be protected from, you know, unfair targets from the union and from... we've had neighbors who had the union come in and trash their camp and then take photos and call the press and just things that make you uncomfortable as a farmer. And so what we felt was that it was a big risk for us to have 40 to 50 employees, some of whom we don't know, working in the summer when there are no rules to operate under. So the hope is that if a bill passes and workers have the right to unionize, which they deserve and which they need, then all of a sudden there are rules for us to play by, the union to play by, and we can offer the jobs that we should be offering. We've cut our workforce down to 15 to 20 instead of 40 to 50. And this time of year, I have people coming to my door and asking for work. Well, on a normal year, I would take their name and number, and then I would call them when the broccoli season started, and that money that they earn is used to support their families. At this time, I have to tell them there is no work. There's 15 to 20 employees that have worked for us for, say, 10 years plus, and we know them well, and those are the people that we employ, and we can't employ, the extra people for the risk of perhaps the union sending someone in to cause trouble and for us to not know, okay, these are the things we need to do, these are the things that the union has to do. I just think the workers need the right to unionize. And that then protects us and it protects the workers. And we want to be able to offer those jobs. People need to be able to support their families. And so that's why I'm here speaking for House Bill 2351.
Madam Chair, are we allowed to ask questions or are we just listening?
We will do the panel first. They have 20 minutes. We will see how the time goes. I do not allow time for the bills at the end, and so we obviously have to control the time.
Thank you.
So if you could hold your question within the 20-minute period. Please continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Mark Simmons. I'm the Public Relations Government Affairs Director for the Oregon Association of Nurserymen. And I want to thank you also for hearing House Bill 2351. We formed a broad coalition in support of this bill, the Pacific Northwest Christmas Trees Association, the Oregon Association of Nurserymen, the Farm Bureau, tree fruit growers, dairy growers, providers, seed growers, and others. This is not a new issue to Oregon. The subject matter of the bill that is before you today has been discussed in this building many times before. In fact, on several occasions, bills have been laid on the governor's desk only to be vetoed. Bills giving the farm workers the right to organize. The first occasion was in 73 when Tom McCall was the governor. The most recent occasion was just last year during the second special session. Agriculture in Oregon today is in need of a fair and balanced framework of laws that regulate the relationship between employers and unions and respectfully recognize the employees' right to choose. Farming is a very difficult business today due to national and international market pressure. Profit margins are slim where there is a profit at all. The Willamette Valley was at one time home to many major food processors who packaged and shipped crops grown here in the Willamette Valley to markets all over the world. Today there's just one major food processor left. The most recent food processor to leave said that Oregon is a high-cost place to do business with too much uncertainty and instability. There's been much disruption and unrest in the relationship between farm workers, farmers, and a union suitor here in the Willamette Valley. Farmers and food processors they sell their crops to today are in a very difficult position and cannot sustain further disruption if we want them to continue producing here. Oregon is an exceptional place to live. And as a matter of public policy, if we value farms and not only the food they produce, but the Christmas trees, grass seed, nursery stock, open space, and quality of life they provide, this problem must be remedied. In the 30s, Congress decided it was appropriate to provide an opportunity for workers to organize and pass the Wagner Act. The successor to the Wagner Act was the National Labor Relations Act. Both of these laws exempted agricultural workers, giving them no opportunity to form a union and be recognized by their employer under law. It was a different time in our nation's history. Farm labor was provided mainly by family members of the farm. Today that has changed, and production agriculture is highly dependent on hired labor to get the job done. We have crafted a bill, the bill that is before you, that is patterned after the National Labor Relations Act. From my former experience as a local union president, I can tell you that the National Labor Relations Act is a fair and balanced framework of law that advantages neither the employer or the employee or the union. If workers see a benefit in forming a union, it works very well and allows them to do so and to keep it in place. This is demonstrated by the fact that it works well today for millions of Americans all across our nation. If workers do not want a union, it allows them to remain unrepresented. We are asking for a fair and balanced framework of law that provides an opportunity for workers and employers and unions to interact with dignity and respect. And above all, this law must respectfully recognize the workers' right of self-determination. The workers' right to act in their own self-interest in an environment free of intimidation or coercion from either employers or unions. Some have suggested that enacting a collective bargaining law for farm workers is not the right approach. That it should instead be addressed through the formation of independent commissions set up between employers and unions. There is such an arrangement in Ohio and Michigan, and it is called the Dunlop Commission. The Dunlop Commission initially covered tomato and cucumber harvesters whose employers sold their crops to Campbell Soups, Heinz, and Dean Foods. After several years, Campbell Soups and Heinz stopped purchasing tomatoes, reportedly because of high cost, and so the farmers stopped growing them. Cucumber acres are down to less than half of what they were when the commission was initially formed, and employers are finding that workers are increasingly dissatisfied with the 2.5% union dues deducted from their paycheck. The research I have done tells me that independent commissions have not worked at all. The only independent commission here in Oregon provides only one union option for farm workers. This, in my opinion, as a former local union president, is a direct affront to the dignity and intelligence of farm workers. Under the National Labor Relations Act, workers always have choices. Under a collective bargaining law, such as we have proposed, several unions could come forward seeking to represent farm workers, and the farm workers could choose between them. We should respect them by providing them the same dignity, choices, and opportunities that other workers here in the United States of America enjoy. The justice provided to farm workers under an independent commission is not justice under law. We are here today again, as we have been in the past, asking that a clear legal roadmap be provided. We are asking that farm workers be allowed to take concerted action through a labor union of their own choosing, that farm workers be allowed to enter into collective bargaining agreements, and that farm workers be allowed to refrain from either of the above. And finally, that they be allowed to do so under the rule of law, just like other workers can. If we are unsuccessful in finding a fair and balanced resolution to this problem, it will only add to the uncertainty and instability agriculture is experiencing in Oregon today. Farmers will have fewer choices in the crops they can grow and market nearby, and farm worker jobs will continue to move to other states and countries. Again, I thank you very much for your willingness to hear this bill, and we look forward to all that lies ahead.
Madam Chair, can I just ask, do you have copies of your testimony?
I will have copies.
And Mr. Bernasik's testimony is being distributed. Please continue.
Chair Close, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tim Bernasik. I'm an attorney representing the Oregon Farm Bureau. I very much appreciate the opportunity to be here today to testify before you and urge your support of House Bill 2351. I understand we're under extreme tight timelines today, and so what I'd like to do, my testimony, is provide a very brief overview of some of the major provisions of the bill. You'll see in my written testimony there is some background discussion. Mark Simmons covered quite adequately, so I will go ahead and move forward into the specific provisions of the bill. However, I would like to comment that what you have in front of you today is a product of very serious, long, drawn-out grassroots discussions on this issue, the result of a commitment that the Oregon Farm Bureau made in front of the House Judiciary Committee in 1999 when Senate Bill 1115 was before you. You may recall Senate Bill 1115 dealt with concerted activity and which concerted activity would be protected for farm workers and which ones would not. Our position then and our position now is that that's a very important issue, but we should not look at that issue alone. It needs to be part of a bigger, broader discussion, a framework that at the core covers the concerted activities that are protected by for agricultural workers, but it's part of a larger whole. And that is a discussion that's been taking place since 1999, grassroots discussions from Marion County to Malheur County, Multnomah County to Klamath County. It's involved support from the Oregon Association of Nurserymen, Pacific Northwest Christmas Tree Growers Association, tree food industry in Columbia Gorge and in Southern Oregon, and various other ag groups as well. So this is a very united front that's come before you to urge your support for this bill. As Mark indicated, the bill is primarily based on the National Labor Relations Act and Oregon's private sector labor law. There's a labor board that, in fact, our provisions of the bill require that the labor board must follow the precedents under the National Labor Relations Act as long as those provisions aren't inconsistent with any specific provision under the bill. The NLRA has had over 70 years of development through rulemaking and case law. In our opinion, it's better to follow existing principles where at all possible rather than devote resources to deal with new provisions under completely unique law in Oregon. So you will see as we go through some of these provisions, they are very similar in most cases to what you will find under the National Labor Relations Act. House Bill 2351 has a section dealing with employee rights. Like the NLRA in Oregon, employees under this bill would have the right to self-organization, to form and join unions, to bargain collectively, to engage in concerted activities, or refrain from any and all such activities. The one exception is that the bill makes a provision that a union, should it be elected the representative of the workers are able to enforce what are called union security provisions to make sure that the union is able to have the financial support it needs to carry out the mandate of the workers, which is to negotiate on their behalf with employers. Again, that is very consistent with the National Labor Relations Act. The bill has a section dealing with employer rights. These are primarily management rights that are non-mandatory bargaining provisions under the national under labor law. We have spelled them out in this bill. They are not spelled out in the National Labor Relations Act, but experienced labor lawyers will see that those provisions are primarily provisions that are non-mandatory bargaining provisions should a union and employer engage in bargaining discussions over wages and working conditions for employees. Then one of the real hearts of the bill are the unfair labor practices. These are practices that can be engaged in by either employers or the unions that infringe on either the employees or the employer's rights. They're delineated employer unfair labor practices. One of those unfair labor practices, again, consistent with the National Labor Relations Act, is to disturb employees in the exercise of their employee rights. Another unfair labor practice would be to refuse to collectively bargain with a certified rep of the workers. And finally, to discriminate against any individual who might invoke processes of the board under the Act. Again, all three of those provisions, there are others, but those provisions are very consistent with the National Labor Relations Act. There are union unfair labor practices. And likewise, just as it is for an employer, it's an unfair labor practice for a union to disturb employees in the exercise of their rights under the bill. It's also an unfair labor practice to discriminate against those who invoke the processes of the board. It's also an unfair labor practice for a union to engage in secondary boycotts. And again, this is, I think, a lot of discussion has revolved around secondary boycotts in this bill, but the provisions under this bill closely parallel. In fact, our initial draft that we sent to Legislative Council was the exact language out of the National Labor Relations Act. So secondary boycotts are very confusing. They're probably the most litigated section of the National Labor Relations Act and probably are most confusing for those that practice under the National Labor Relations Act. But essentially what a secondary boycott is when a party, a union for example, exerts economic pressure against a neutral party intending for that party to exert pressure on an individual with whom the union might have a primary dispute to induce that primary employer to give in to some of the union demands. This is, as you go through, whether it's National Labor Relations Act or even before the Act, it has been a long time held a violation of public policy. Under state common law, we have cases like Bricklayers International Union versus Seymour Ruff. Under the Sherman Antitrust Act, Duplex Printing Press Company versus Deering, and then, of course, under the Taft-Hartley Amendments to the National Labor Relations Act in 1947, have all laid out that secondary boycotts are patently unfair to pick on a neutral third party when your dispute is with the primary employer. And so we too, feel that for the health of the agricultural industry, it is very important to have these provisions in the law, and again, it very closely parallels the National Labor Relations Act, the language that is in this bill. We've also created a unique provision in that it would be an unfair labor practice for a union to engage in a strike during the harvest time of agricultural products. Our view is that it serves nobody's best interest, employers or workers, to engage in strikes during the most critical time period in agriculture. Agriculture is unique from a lot of industries in that many times it's a week or 2 weeks is a whole entire year's worth of investment from the employer. And it's also the time when the employees, if you look at employment patterns in a lot of agricultural industries, it's a time when most employees are employed. And so to engage in a strike during this time serves no one's best interest, and we've got to find a better way of dealing with disputes that might occur during the harvest time. Very quickly, the bill also has a certification process that details how a union is to be elected or how employees could choose whether or not they want to be represented by a union. One unique provision here is that bargaining units are divided into seasonal workers and year-round full-time workers, and we have developed an expedited process for seasonal workers, realizing that if we relied on the 30 to 40 day or longer period between the time a petition for an election is submitted by, say, a union, and the time that the union is actually certified or the election results are certified, 30, 40 or longer days would make it impossible for seasonal workers to effectively organize under this law. So we've developed an expedited process for seasonal workers that would call for an election 14 days after the petition is filed, and would allow an additional 5-day period for either unions, employers, or employees to submit any charges of unfair labor practices that might have occurred during the election process to be resolved by the board. So rather than, you know, 30 to 40 days, we've got an expedited process for seasonal workers. Finally, the labor board, and I know time is getting very tight. This is a unique provision in the bill. Rather than relying on political appointments to fill these boards and then wide swings in interpretations of rules depending on the political party that's in charge, these have been complaints under the National Labor Relations Board that you had the Reagan-Bush board, which was replaced by the Clinton board, which is now being replaced by the Bush board. It's very difficult under those circumstances as a labor lawyer to advise your clients what they should and should not do under the law when you have wide swings in the philosophical perspective of the board. So we're putting forward a new unique process, which would call for an election of 5 nonpartisan representatives, and these representatives would be based on the boundaries of the existing 5 congressional districts in the state. The board would write rules, would administer elections under the law, and hear any unfair labor practice charges. It would be housed in the Department of Agriculture, and board members would be volunteers with the same per diem as other board members, board and commission members in the state.
Jim, we are out of time.
Thank you very much.
Panel, I will allow 5 minutes of questioning, I guess. That's going to take us, it's going to take away from the other 2 bills, but I think it's important that we have 5 minutes of testimony. And I want the committee to know before we start this that the purpose of this hearing is to set forth the issues. And then because there's wide disagreement, there will be a work group appointed. This is not the bill that we're going to be voting on. This will be a work group that we will be appointing, and I will tell you more about that at the end of this. But in your questioning, remember that, please. So we will give 5 minutes, and you want to set the clock. Okay, Anders and Shuffler.
I share the plight of the farmer. I've made that perfectly clear in this room. And I don't, Ms. Paulette Pyle distributed some information on these Animal Liberation Front and Earth Liberation Front people who go out and trash things. And that very much upsets me. And I don't want that. And I absolutely, totally disagree with that kind of behavior. But you made some pretty serious allegations, and I just want to clarify this. Were the folks that vandalized your property captured and convicted?
And actually, it was our neighbor. It was the Willamette Organics, yeah. And we went out and had interviewed some of the workers and interviewed the people, and it's in the courts at this point.
So they did catch the people that did it?
Yes.
And they're directly related in workers and employees of the union?
I believe that they were... union and was Oregon Law Center people who had come directly after that. These are friends of ours who had a labor camp. It was not run by them, but they ran the farm. And then their workers reported that the people came in, that they were from Pocoon and also from there were people there, and I don't know who actually tipped the garbage cans over. But they did then call the press. They came in and they took pictures. To know more details, I would have to call and ask, and I'd be glad to, you know, have them give some information to you. Again, it's in the courts now, and I don't know the outcome.
Well, I just want everyone, Madam Chair, if you would just remind everyone that, I mean, I just to make these allegations without specific evidence and convictions, I think, I just don't really want to add that here, please.
And I apologize.
We're after the truth, and people have a right to come up and say things on the record, and then they're held accountable for what they say.
Thank you.
Well, and I apologize for not having maybe the information that I need to be able to do that, but I do believe I could go and get that information and come back, and I apologize that I had not done that.
Other questions? Representative Rosenbaum. Again.
Thank you.
3 minutes.
Thank you. I hope I won't take that long. Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess this would be a question for Tim or Mark. Both of you talked about the fact that this bill is modeled on the National Labor Relations Act, and yet I see a number of provisions in here that are not contained in the NLRA or, in fact, in any public or private sector collective bargaining law that I'm familiar with. And specifically, I wanted to ask you about this prohibition on strikes during a significant period of time. That is not a feature of private sector labor law or public sector labor law, except for public safety, which is a whole different area. And then also dictating to the union what means it uses to call for a strike. That is really unprecedented in my experience. And so I wanted to ask you where those provisions came from, because I'm somewhat familiar with California's farm worker collective bargaining law, and it doesn't seem to mirror anything in their law either.
Chair Close, Representative Rosenbaum, there are a number of states that have enacted, as Mark indicated, the National Labor Relations Act has exempted agriculture, so it's been basically left up to individual states to decide whether or not they want to enact collective bargaining legislation. A number of states have. California is one of them. Arizona and Idaho are a couple of other states that have done so, and both states, Arizona and Idaho, do have provisions that do not allow for strikes during harvest. And so we have, the provisions in this bill do mirror the provisions in those bills. I think you're absolutely right that in the National Labor Relations Act and other public sector laws, that it's primarily public safety issues where we don't allow strikes. But I think that there are some unique situations that in agriculture, for example, the seasonality of workers. We've created provision to deal with a very short time frame to expedite elections to make sure that it is possible if seasonal workers should choose to be representative, they have a process to do that. And likewise, I think that the issue of strikes during harvest, there's got to be another way, and we're open to any suggestions that anyone might have, but there has got to be a better way to deal with work stoppages at a time when it's absolutely critical for both farmers and farm workers, where the income levels for both participants are at their most vulnerable, that we deal with disputes rather than the traditional going out on strike. And that's what we've tried to do with this bill.
Thank you very much, and we are out of time. Appreciate your presentation, and we will call for the labor union panel, Brad Witt, AFL-CIO, Xavier Seja. Rosa Chapin. And while they're coming, I'd like to speak more about the work group. It's going to be 8 members. There'll be one from the Senate, one from the House, 2 union representatives, one from PACUM, one from AFL-CIO, 2 from industry, and a member of the governor's office, and then the chair of the work group, which I will chair the work group.
Madam Chair, I just want to say for the record, the anecdotal testimony from either side or any side or any perspective, for me, without clear-cut evidence, whether it be from growers or labor, I'm really not interested in that. So just for the record, I didn't want to... that was not just against farmers. That goes for labor and anybody else. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Schaffler. And I will remind everybody that... you are on the record when you speak here, and there are laws on the books and in our statutes against perjury or misrepresenting yourselves, and that's on the sign-in sheet when you sign into this committee. So if you want to look it up, the ORS is stated. Okay, we will set your time and welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Brad Witt, Secretary-Treasurer of the Oregon AFL-CIO. There are 180,000 AFL-CIO members in the state of Oregon. I am appearing in opposition today to House Bill 2351. This is a bill that purports to provide, quote, collective bargaining that is fair and equitable to agricultural employees, labor organizations, and employers, unquote. Unfortunately, the bill only provides for meet and confer language, and that does not constitute collective bargaining. In fact, the bill stands in sharp contrast to collective bargaining by stating, quote, the failure or refusal of either party to agree to a proposal, to make, change, or withdraw a lawful proposal, or to make a concession does not constitute and is not direct or indirect evidence of a breach of that obligation. In return for the potentially meaningless meet and confer language, the bill envisions farm workers giving up economic action during harvest times, that time when the greatest economic leverage would be gained, in addition giving up secondary and consumer boycotts. This can hardly be characterized as a fair and equitable deal, given what the farm workers would be asked to give up in return for really little, if anything. House Bill 2351 contains a litany of other unfair and inequitable proposals. Employers may escape the obligation to meet and confer by hiring a farm labor contractor. This problem appears on page 2 at lines 12 to 14. Employers, not the Oregon Agricultural Labor Relations Board, determine the status of seasonal employees with respect to the constitution of bargaining units. This appears on page 2 at lines 29 to 30. Seasonal employees and regular employees must form separate bargaining units, page 5, lines 21 to 22, which diminishes union bargaining strength and sets the stage for employers to whipsaw the two different categories of workers. By prohibiting union successorship clauses on page 3, lines 9 to 12, the bill may be an unconstitutional impairment of the right to contract. The ability of employers to whipsaw regular and seasonal bargaining units is enhanced by the employer's unlimited right to contract out work and determine the makeup of crews on page 4, lines 4 to 15, and also includes their ability to hire independent contractors on page 8, lines 22 to 23. The bill undermines the union's representation function by allowing individual resolution of grievances on page 4, lines 21 to 23. Authorization for union representation is likely to be unsuccessful during off-peak seasons. It's a bad pun, but it would be perhaps fruitless to attempt a union representation election during the off-peak season. Representation authorizations must be signed by 30% or more of eligible employees of a particular employer when the number of current employees is at least 50% of the peak number of employees within the preceding 12-month period. This appears on page 4, lines 28 to 30. However, decertification of such representation only requires one employee. That appears on page 4 at lines 39 to 40. Union certification elections require 50% of the eligible employees to cast ballots, and of that group, 50% of the valid votes cast must favor union representation in order for the union to be certified. The supermajority is an unrealistic hurdle which factors in non-votes in determining the outcome of an election. Supervisory employees are allowed to vote in the union election on page 5 at lines 11 to 16, and this presumably would dilute the union's support in that election. There is no upper limit in the bill for conducting union certification elections. Given the highly seasonal and transitory nature of farm labor, workers may no longer be subject employees when the elections are actually held. The bill gives non-union members the right to object to the funding of union activities on page 7, lines 10 to 15. Even worse, supervisory employees would presumably have equal standing to make such objections. The bill may unconstitutionally limit the number of unions to which an employee may belong. It's a freedom of association problem on page 7 at lines 27 to 29. The bill would make the recognition of a picket line, i.e. the refusal to cross a picket line, an unfair labor practice. Presumably, that may be the very intent of a picket line. The bill's attempts to regulate picketing of highways, railways, and airports is probably preempted by the National Labor Relations Act and the Railway Labor Act. These problems occur on page 8, lines 8 to 9. The bill requires unions to make annual public financial disclosures of all receipts and expenditures at page 8, lines 43 to 45, and we would suggest that in the interests of equity and fairness, all employers, subject employers, would be required to disclose the same information. It's an unfair labor practice under the bill to, quote, take unauthorized possession of an employer's property, unquote. This is a severe disincentive for labor camp residents to take part in economic action against their employers. The bill gives union access to employer-owned farm worker camps until such time as the employer or anyone else asks the union to leave. This would be the ephemeral access clause in the bill. Lastly, 10-day strike notices may effectively mean that strikes are of little impact under House Bill 2351. Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2351 would establish collective begging as the preferred method of labor relations in Oregon agriculture. Until such time as full and fair collective bargaining rights are bestowed upon farm workers, the Oregon AFL-CIO will remain in opposition to such demeaning proposals, and we urge the committee's opposition on that basis as well. Thank you.
Thank you, and you have 13 minutes.
Pues, buenos días. Yo, mi nombre es Javier Ceja, y muchas gracias por darme la oportunidad de hablarles hoy. Tengo aquí en los Estados Unidos más de 20 años, trabajando en los files, las mercerías, las canerías. Pues quiero comentar sobre la propuesta de ley para establecer el sistema de convenios colectivos en la agricultura.
Good morning. My name is Javier Ceja. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak today. I've lived in the United States and worked in the fields, in nurseries, and in canneries for over 20 years, and I want to comment on the proposal to establish a system of collective bargaining in agriculture.
Yo creo que ni podemos tomar en serio esta propuesta, porque solamente representa la perspectiva de los señores rancheros. No toma en cuenta la situación del trabajador campesino. Esta es una propuesta de la Asociación de Rancheros que solamente les conviene a ellos.
The way I view this, we cannot take this proposal seriously, since it represents the perspective of the growers and does not take into account the situation of the farm worker. This is a proposal from the Farm Bureau that only benefits growers.
Esta propuesta la veo como un insulto para los campesinos. Los rancheros están demostrando que no toman en serio las necesidades y los intereses de los campesinos. Esta propuesta para mí es inaceptable.
This proposal is an insult to farm workers. It shows that growers do not take seriously the needs or interests of farm workers. This proposal, as is not acceptable.
Esta propuesta quiere dar todo el poder a los rancheros, busca controlar aún más al trabajador a través de un sistema burocrático e injusto. Por ejemplo, propone que el ranchero tenga el derecho de dividir a la gente que trabaja en el rancho en grupos separados, según si trabajan como permanentes, temporales o como un contratista.
This proposal gives all the power to the growers. It seeks to control workers even more through a bureaucratic and unjust system. For example, it proposes that the grower have the right to divide the people working on his farm into separate groups, depending on whether they are permanent or temporary workers, or if they work for a labor contractor.
Si todos los trabajadores trabajan en el mismo rancho, no hay por qué formar grupos separados para votar por la unión o para negociar un contrato. Es simplemente una maniobra patronal para dificultar la organización de una elección.
If all the workers work on the same farm, there is no reason to put them in separate groups when it comes to union elections or negotiating a contract. This is simply a management ploy to make organizing for a union election more difficult.
Todos los trabajadores de un rancho deben tener el derecho de votar como un grupo unido por la unión siempre que ellos así lo decidan.
All the workers on a farm should have the right to vote as a united group for a union if they want it.
Todo el proceso que esta ley propone para tener elecciones sindicales en los ranchos está equivocado. Esta propuesta con tanta burocracia no nos sirve y hay que hacer una que sirva a las circunstancias distintas de los campesinos.
The entire process that is proposed to hold union elections on farms is flawed. This proposal is so bureaucratic that it does not work for us. it is necessary to have a proposal that will function, given the unique circumstances faced by farm workers.
Así que proponer que haya un tiempo de espera de por lo menos 14 días de trabajo o 18 días en el calendario antes de tener elecciones sindicales para trabajadores temporales no nos ayuda en nada. El campesino no trabaja todo el año en el mismo sitio, sino que la cosecha muchas veces solamente dura dos o tres semanas.
Thus, proposing that there be a waiting period of at least 14 business days or 18 calendar days before a union election for seasonal workers doesn't help us at all. Farm workers do not work the entire year in one place, since harvests often come to an end within two or three weeks.
No tiene caso tener una elección después de la cosecha. Por eso es tan importante hacerlo dentro de una semana a más tardar, o sería mejor tener una elección dentro de los tres días de trabajo. Hay que respetar las condiciones de trabajo del campesino para tener una ley que pueda funcionar.
There is no point in having an election once the harvest is over. Because of this, it is very important to hold elections within a week at the most. It would be even better to hold them within three working days. It is necessary to respect the working conditions of farm workers to create a functional law.
Desde mi punto de vista, a mi testimonio, esta propuesta representa solamente los intereses del ranchero y hace más para perjudicar al campesino que para darle derecho de tener unión. Bajo esta propuesta, los campesinos nunca van a lograr tener la unión. Es tan inaceptable que ni siquiera merece su discusión para mí.
In my point of view, from my testimony, this proposal only represents growers' interests and does more to damage farm workers than to give them the right to unionize. Farm workers will never unionize under this proposal. It is so unacceptable that it does not even merit discussion.
¿Pudiera hacer un comentario o agregar un comentario más?
I just want to add one other thing.
El otro persona, el señor que estuvo aquí, y lo que dice la ley en contra del boicoteo, mi comentario aquí es que si no fuera por el boicoteo, no estuviéramos ahorita discutiendo esta propuesta, aunque sea esta.
And just regarding these comments about boycotts, I think that this whole proposal has just come out of the issue of the boycott. That's really what's brought this about.
Gracias.
Thank you, Mr. Ceja. I hope I didn't massacre your name. Rosa Chapin. And we have 7 minutes.
Buenos días. Me llamo Rosa Chapina, soy trabajadora del campo y vivo en Ceilán. Yo estoy completamente opuesta a esta propuesta. Para mí una unión representa un apoyo muy importante, porque sin la unión no hay nadie que apoye ni escuche al campesino. Pero también es muy importante que la unión tenga sus derechos, sus fuerzas más importantes como de hacer huelga o boicoteo. Quitarnos estos derechos sería como cortarnos los pies y las manos.
My name is Rosa Chapina. I'm a farm worker and I live in Ceylon. I'm absolutely opposed to this proposal. For me, a union is a very important source of support, because without a union, there is no one to support or to listen to the farm workers. But it is also very important that the union have its rights, its strength, such as the strike or boycott. Taking away these rights would be like cutting off our hands and feet.
Uno ve tanta injusticia en el campo. Es ahí donde trabaja la gente más marginada. Hay gente que no habla ni se quejan por miedo. Gente que no sabe leer el inglés ni leer o escribir. Allí en el campo uno recibe el peor trato, pero uno se aguanta porque es la única manera de llevar comida a la familia. El trabajo del campesino es lo más difícil que hay, en que hay que trabajar en el frío y el sol, y es el trabajo más mal pagado y en que se trata más mal a la gente.
One sees so much injustice in the fields. The people who work in the fields are the most marginalized. There are people who don't speak out or complain out of fear, people who don't speak English or know how to read and write. In the fields, one receives the worst treatment, but one must put up with it because it is the only way to bring food home to one's family. Farm work is the most difficult that there is and requires work in the cold and heat. And yet it is also the worst paid work that most mistreats people.
Tengo entendido que esta ley propone quitarnos el derecho de hacer huelga durante la cosecha. A mí se me hace ridículo eso. No pueden controlar o poner un horario para una cosa así. Si se presenta la ocasión y la necesidad, hay que hacer una huelga. La huelga es una de las únicas cosas que nos ayudan. Cuando ya se levantó la cosecha, no tiene chiste hacer una huelga, porque el ranchero ya se benefició, mientras el trabajador queda en una situación igual o a lo mejor peor que antes.
I understand that this bill proposes to take from us the right to strike during harvest season. This seems ridiculous to me. One cannot control or schedule such events. If the occasion and the necessity arise, a strike must occur. The strike is the only thing that can help us. Once the harvest is over, there's no point in striking because the grower has already benefited while the worker remains in the same or possibly worse situation.
Hay muchos motivos para hacer una huelga. A veces no pagan todas las horas, no pagan el overtime. Hay malas condiciones del trabajo, injusticias, malos tratos y falta de seguridad. Hay que defenderse en el trabajo. En el campo tratan mal a la gente. La huelga nos ayuda a hacer valer nuestros derechos. Es la única forma en que nos escuchan.
There are many reasons to go out on strike. Sometimes employers do not pay all the hours one has worked, do not pay overtime. There are poor working conditions, injustices, bad treatment, and lack of safety and security. It is necessary to defend oneself at work. People in the fields are treated badly. A strike helps us express our rights, and is the only way we will be listened to.
Uno sale en huelga porque ya no aguanta más, ni le importa si va a perder horas de trabajo. La huelga es un punto clave de la unión, porque nos unimos para hacer que nos escuchen y que respeten nuestros derechos.
Workers go out on strike because they cannot stand to work any longer, and it is no longer important to them if they miss hours of work. The right to strike is a key point to having a union, since we unite in the strike to be listened to and to ensure that our rights are respected.
El derecho de boicotear también tiene importancia, porque es una manera importante de presionar al ranchero y ganar el apoyo de la comunidad. No es un delito hacer un boicoteo, sino un derecho. El boicoteo es necesario. La comunidad también tiene mucho poder si decide no comprar algún producto.
The right to boycott is also very important, since it is a powerful way to pressure an employer and also gain the support of the community. It is not a crime to boycott, but a right. Boycotts are necessary. The community also has a great deal of power if it decides not to buy a product.
Es este un apoyo que les ayuda tanto a los campesinos para que sigan fuertes y para hacer que el ranchero negocie un contrato.
It is this support that helps farm workers to continue to stand strong and to bring a grower to the negotiating table.
La unión debe de tener derecho a hacer huelga o boicoteo y debe de tener fuerza para hacer presión al ranchero para negociar asuntos importantes como mejor trato, un sueldo justo y otros beneficios. Los rancheros son los que quieren poner un sindicato sin ninguno de estos derechos. Pero ¿cuál es la razón de tener sindicato si no tiene fuerza para negociar? Eso es otro ejemplo de cómo nos están pisoteando nuestros derechos como seres humanos y no puede ser. Gracias.
The union must have the right to strike or boycott, and it must be strong to pressure growers and to negotiate important issues such as better treatment, a fair wage, and other benefits. The growers are the ones who say they want a union, but without these rights. What is the reason of having a union if one does not have the power to negotiate? This is yet another example of how our rights as human beings are being trampled, which cannot continue. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. We will go to questions. Representative Kitts has a question.
amigo y amiga, gracias para hablando aquí today. Pero mi porque no hablo español bien, solamente inglés. Okay?
Sir, what did he say?
I'm afraid now. Does he know?
I just apologize that I only speak English well. But they have a translator. It will hopefully help them. Mr. Witt, my question is for you, and it's my understanding after reading the bill, and just correct me if I'm wrong, but it's my understanding after reading the bill as written that the actions that took place between NORPAC and Pocoon, for the most part, would still be acceptable. Is this accurate? Am I reading the bill accurately?
My initial, Madam Chair, Representative Fitz, my initial read or take on the bill would be that it does not. I think I would need to read the bill here in greater detail with that specific case in mind, which I have not done.
Okay, I guess this is just off of what Representative Schaffler had said earlier, and I would echo that. So before we say what could or could not be done, I would hope that we know.
I was reading from the various provisions of the bill, which in fact do outlaw or would outlaw secondary and consumer boycotts. So
okay.
I believe that information is contained on page 9.
You want the lines?
Yeah, I will read through it. I disagree, but I will be more than happy to talk with you later.
Okay, I would enjoy that opportunity as well.
Thank you.
Mr. Witt, I had a question. You talked about crossing picket lines, and you said that harassment, I'm not sure what your word was, for crossing it should not be an Unfair Labor Practices Act. It's my understanding that's already standard National Labor Relations Act verbiage that you cannot harass people for crossing a picket line. Could you respond to that?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my reference was into the relative success of a picket line in preventing people from crossing that picket line. If employees, by their own choosing, decided to honor that picket line and not cross it, I think a reasonable interpretation of this bill's language would suggest that that could be interpreted as an unfair labor practice, and that is entirely contrary to the concept of establishing a picket line.
So, to follow up, would you be against harassing people who did cross it? Would you be for including that as an unfair labor practice if you did harass a person who crossed the picket line?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I did not address specific instances of what might be construed to be violence or intimidation, and we do not condone in any form any kind of intimidation of that sort. So.
Okay. Thank you. Other questions? Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Brad, no one's talked about this section on employers' rights, and there's not much time, but I wonder if you could just briefly comment, because it says that the employer has the right to contract work out, make work assignments, determine time and place of work. Those are provisions that also aren't contained in the National Labor Relations Act. Do you know what the effect of that would be on trying to bargain a contract?
Madam Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, while they are not contained in the text of the National Labor Relations Act, it is presumed in many instances that it is a management prerogative for management to entertain many of those actions. Nevertheless, as I tried to point out in my testimony, the ability of giving employers to determine the makeup of the bargaining unit and also to be able to contract out work and also presumably to constitute a bargaining unit exclusively of independent contractors are all readily achievable means for busting a union and or frustrating entirely the negotiations process.
Thank you. We are out of time. Thank you so much for your testimony. And we will call our last panel of Adrian Delgado and Trini Marquez. And we will do 15 minutes on this panel since our third person was not able to be here.
Yeah.
Morning. Welcome.
Morning. Sorry, nobody came to get us. We were watching you guys on TV.
Buenos días. Mi nombre es Edrin Delgado. Y quiero contar un poco de lo que conozco yo de, porque he sido miembro de la Unión en California por 10 años. Y quiero contar un poco de lo que conozco y por qué no estoy de acuerdo en lo que la Unión de aquí propone.
Hi, my name is Adrian Delgado, and I've been part of a union for some time in California, 10 years. And I'm here to testify against the union here in Oregon because he's not on behalf of what the union proposes to do here in Oregon.
You can pull the other microphone over if you'd like.
And me. Conocimiento sobre la unión en California. Nosotros tuvimos una propuesta, unos compañeros míos tuvieron una propuesta de la unión. Nosotros estábamos muy bien en el trabajo y por ellos fue que entró la unión y nosotros teníamos muy buena comunicación con los patrones, muy buenos sueldos, y esto nos causó un problema meter la unión.
He worked in a company that was very well communication between the workers and the owners, and because of some friends of his that decided to bring in the union, that's when the problem started. They had good wages, they had a good working environment, but everything changed as soon as the union came in.
También cuando pusimos la unión, yo fui miembro de la mesa directiva por 3 años y lo que a nosotros nos afectó fue que nosotros en el trabajo que teníamos era uno de los, en las hongueras era uno de los mejores trabajos, de muy bien pagados, y los patrones no les gustó que nosotros metiéramos la unión. No sé qué fue lo que pasó, pero todos a los 3 años nosotros tuvimos que votar cuando se nos terminó el contrato para poder sacar la unión, porque ellos y el Estado tuvieron una auditoría y presentaron pruebas de que iban perdiendo, tenían pérdidas en el trabajo, y nos rebajaron el sueldo, nos quitaron todo lo que habíamos ganado más beneficios que ya teníamos.
He served on the committee, the union committee, or the board that was representing the union for 3 years. And after the contract was up, then they were asked to vote in again, whether to vote in the union or not. The owners of the mushroom factory that he worked at also asked to vote, and they presented documents where they had taken in bosses, so that represented that they had to take wage cuts and benefits that had already accumulated over the years. So because of the union coming in, benefits and wages were cut.
Excuse me, order. We'll have order. I'm sorry, we're not going to allow that. Go ahead.
If she would like to come up and translate, if she's more professional, I have no problem.
No, we're going to continue on this testimony. Go ahead.
Por eso, ahora lo que yo no estoy de acuerdo es de que la unión quiere que haya huelga, la unión quiere que haya boicoteo, y yo no estoy de acuerdo en eso, porque las huelgas lo que hacen es quitarle el trabajo a la gente. Yo he tenido experiencias aquí que como el 93, 94, 150 trabajadores, 200 trabajadores andaban piscando fresa, la unión andaba haciendo huelga, únicamente 2-3 trabajadores salían. Si la gente no está de acuerdo con lo que está trabajando, con lo que el patrón les está pagando, la gente sale a hablar con ellos o a apoyarlos, pero si la gente no los apoya, si de 150 a 200 personas son únicamente 3 personas los están apoyando, es que la gente está contenta con lo que está haciendo, lo que está trabajando.
Since he's been working here, he's also experienced a a strike. I'm sorry if I didn't look for my word. And out of, 200 or so that have been out in the field, 3 of them leave to support the strike. That's a very big percentage. He says that boycotts and strikes only hurt the workers, not necessarily, help the union.
Yo pienso que como trabajador que soy, siempre hace falta que oigan el testimonio de las personas que trabajamos, porque si nosotros tenemos un problema, yo siempre he mirado yo en un trabajo, en todos los trabajos hay un papel enfrente de los trabajos, cuando uno va a empezar a trabajar está las reglas de la compañía, está las leyes por el estado de Oregon y siempre hay un número de teléfono. Si uno tiene un problema por el patrón, uno puede hablar a ese número y decir que están violando las leyes de uno, que no le están pagando uno bien. Entonces uno tiene el derecho de, si uno está, lo están tratando mal o están violándole las leyes, uno puede hablar, pero no que la unión venga a acosarlo a uno, que tenemos que hacer huelga, dejar de trabajar. Nosotros tenemos que trabajar para mantener las familias.
When they go look for a job, there's always postings on the boards where they know the Oregon law is right there. There's phone numbers of places that are given if they need to report any problems with the worker or the employer. Excuse me. So to them, they feel like, at least he feels like he's informed of his rights. He knows that where he can call, where he can go if he needs to report if there's bad treatment in the workplace. He doesn't think the union should be pressuring them to join if they're working and knowing they have to bring food home. They don't see why the union should come in and disrupt that.
Por eso yo estoy de acuerdo en que haya una unión, que esté una unión, porque yo creo que sí puede existir lugares donde las personas necesitan de buscar apoyo, porque algunos patrones no sean buenos con la gente, que no los traten bien, que no les paguen bien, pero que cada persona tenga el derecho de buscar ayuda cuando la necesite, no que la estén acosando. Yo, de mi parte, si yo necesito la unión, voy y la busco, y si todos mis compañeros están de acuerdo que metamos la unión, la metemos, pero si no estamos de acuerdo, nosotros no queremos saber nada de la unión. Y hasta ahorita tengo más de 20 años trabajando aquí en Estados Unidos, 10, 14 años en California, los otros 10 años aquí nunca he necesitado unión. Hay lugares que si está uno trabajando bien, le pagan uno bien, yo lo único que ganaría era pagar una cuota a la unión, sería todo lo que yo ganaría. Así que yo estoy de acuerdo que cada persona pueda votar y meter la unión si es que la necesita, y si no la necesita, que no se meta la unión para nada.
He agrees that if a person needs to vote for a union or a committee or someone to help them with the problem, they have that right to vote for it. But that the union should not be pressuring them to join them. They should have the right to go looking for them, not the union coming to pressure them to join. He does realize that there are some farmers out there where they are being mistreated. So if that's the case, he advises that they search for help instead of being pressured into making other people join a union where they don't think is needed. He's worked 14 years in California, 10 here, and he's never here in Oregon. He's never needed to go after a union.
Creo que es todo lo que tengo que decir. Yo esto que digo es porque lo hablo con mis compañeros durante las cosechas allí únicamente donde yo trabajo trabajan bastantes personas, alrededor de 100-150 personas en la pizca de la fresa, pero ellos van, yo conozco personas que van por 2 días a piscar, conozco personas que vienen por una semana, pero ellos únicamente lo que quieren es trabajar y no tienen problemas, nunca han tenido problemas ellos, porque ahorita una persona que tiene problemas ahorita ya no es igual que antes. Uno ahorita puede hablar a donde quiera, te dan los teléfonos, como les digo, enfrente de siempre de un trabajo, cuando van a entrar en un fil, siempre enfrente, al empezar el fil está un cartelón con números de teléfonos que uno puede hablar para buscar ayuda. Así que ahorita no creo que las personas tengan que buscar una unión por 2 días o 3 días que vengan a trabajar al fil. Los que trabajamos por el año completo estamos, yo estoy hablando de mis compañeros, estamos bien. Las partes que yo he trabajado en diferentes lugares por una semana, 2 semanas, siempre he trabajado bien y yo miro a la gente que trabaja bien.
Please speak up if you could a little bit for the record.
At the place that he works now, there's around 100 to 150 workers that come to work. Some of them come in and work 2 days to a week during the strawberry season. And, you know, he says that some of them come in to work, whether they want to work or not, they'll leave if they don't like the job. The others stick around because they like working there. I'm going to make this shorter because he does kind of overstate himself. But he says that at the place that he's worked with his co-workers, they've never had any problem. He's a full-time, all-year person there, and they're fine. They don't have any complaints, and he again emphasizes that there is phone numbers and places they can contact if they do have problems before they even go out into the field.
Okay, and did you want to give your own testimony, or you're just interpreting? You do. Okay, we have about 3 minutes ago.
My name is Trini Marquez. I've been in Oregon for like 36 years now. My parents came up here, and ever since then, I've been working in the field year to year, not as a full-time worker. I do go out in the field only in the summertime. I kind of break the law, and I'm sorry to say that, but I'm one that thinks that kids have to learn discipline and be able to work, but at a very early age. I feel that I'm the person I am because my parents took me out there when I was little, and that's what I've inputted into my kids. So I don't think, you know, the child labor law is kind of one that has hurt me and my family. And I don't think that we need a union to speak up for a lot of the people. I understand that some people may need that, but I think there's other ways to go around that than to have one union.
Thank you very much. We have about 1 minute for questions. Okay. There are none. I appreciate your testimony and bringing this perspective on this issue. Thank you. Okay, that concludes our invited testimony. I want to make it clear we will take written testimony on this issue from anyone who wants to submit it. We will be going into a work group on this issue, and we want input from everyone, so please feel free to do that. And we will intend to bring this bill back. So I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 2351. And I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2969, have the staff read the summary.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 2969 establishes the Office of Small Business within the Economic and Community Development Department, and it establishes the Small Business Council. The bill has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Okay. And we're getting our sign-up sheet. I'll call Eric Blackledge. He is in the room.
He checked in.
We will stand these until we can find Mr. Blackledge.
Okay. Oh, so I'll give this to him then.
Once more. As you know, over 97% of Oregon businesses are small businesses, and they provide more than 57% of all state jobs. Recent research also indicates that small businesses are responsible for the vast majority of new job growth in the U.S. economy, particularly during recessionary periods, and they're a major source of technology innovation and new product development. Over 20% of Oregon small businesses are in the manufacturing, agricultural, and technical services sectors, which also brings new traded sector dollars into the state economy, very important from the standpoint of our overall economic growth. Because of the economic importance of small business, the state provides various assistance programs for small business through a number of state agencies which offer training support and regulatory compliance assistance. Special assistance programs and agency advocates also exist for woman-owned businesses and minority-owned businesses because of their unique circumstances. However, because many of these programs are housed in separate agencies, they are often not well coordinated and managed for maximum efficiency and service for the small business community. This bill provides a coordination point for these various programs through a state office of small business in OECDD and defines the roles and responsibilities of the office. And both Governor Kulongowski and the legislative leadership have called for an increased focus by all areas of state government in assisting businesses and helping to regrow the Oregon economy. And this bill implements that kind of focus on increased efficiency in assisting small businesses in stimulating business and job growth. It is illogical for one state agency, such as OEDD, to spend taxpayer dollars to stimulate economic growth when other state agencies may be blocking that growth or not assisting that growth with unneeded regulations or inefficient permitting processes. Without interagency coordination, some state programs may be duplicative and inefficient, while other business needs may go unmet by any agency. Let me walk you through the bill and the provisions of the legislation. Section 1 of the bill makes the existing Small Business Assistance Program at OECDD the state's Office of Small Business and outlines its objectives for coordinating state assistance programs and promoting the survival and growth of small businesses in Oregon. Although the department currently performs many of the same business advocacy functions listed in this bill, this act provides new encouragement for the department's small business programs and also gives the office the authority to assist other agencies, other areas of state government, in coordinating or improving their small business services or regulatory programs. An example of this kind of interaction would be the reviewing of small business regulatory impact statements from other agencies, as we discussed at Monday's hearing on House Bill 2967. The Regulatory Flexibility Bill. Other examples of activities that could be coordinated by the Office of Small Business include high-efficiency multi-agency communication programs to small businesses or joint workshops that could be conducted throughout the state to make it more efficient for each agency to interface with small business and help to try to resolve their problems. Because of the state's limited budget resources for the 03-05 biennium, no significant new activities or any additional staff will be currently added to the Economic and Community Development Department beyond the current program levels by this legislation. Although all of the department's activities have some impact on small businesses because of the dominance of small businesses in the Oregon economy, currently only two FTE staff positions out of the 109 positions in the department are actually dedicated to small business support. Essentially, the same bill language with an added provision for additional staffing was introduced last session as House Bill 2858, a department bill, and was approved by the committee but died in the Ways and Means Committee because of potential cost considerations. The department also submitted the same bill with that added staffing and funding to the governor's office this session, but it also was not included in the governor's package, probably because of the cost of the legislation. As a result, we have removed all requests for additional funding to focus the office instead on the coordination and efficiency of existing programs in both OECDD and in other state agencies. Section 2 of the bill establishes a Small Business Council and makes it an advisory committee to the Economic and Community Development Department on small business issues. This section also defines the council's membership criteria and appointment process. This statutory advisory council would replace the Governor's Small Business Council, which I'm currently the vice chair of, which was created 5 years ago by Executive Order 9814.
The Governor's Small Business Council has been staffed by OECDD since its formation, but it currently lacks any specific advisory relationship to either the Department or the Economic Development Commission, because it was created by the governor by executive order. Because the new agency advisory council would replace the existing small business council, there would also be no additional expense or staffing burden or appointment burden as a result of converting this to a statutory advisory committee. Section 3 of the bill defines the role of a small business council in advising state government on small business problems and advocating for effective solutions to them. Section 4 of the bill simply sets the terms of office for council appointments and the initial terms. Over the last 5 years, the Governor's Small Business Council has conducted statewide roundtables to better understand the needs and problems of small businesses. We conducted a statewide small business summit to define those problems and to develop potential solutions. We've also met with representatives of most of the state agencies with small business-related programs to learn about their activities and to help give them advice and to consult with them on making those programs more effective for small businesses. And we've also looked at successful small business assistance programs in other states. Based upon all of this research and many, many days of discussion on how to best meet the needs of the small business community, the highest priority recommendation of the Governor's Small Business Council in both our 2000 and also in our 2002 report, which I gave to you at the beginning of the session, was the establishment of an Office of Small Business. So I would ask that you help us to implement that recommendation by supporting House Bill 2969. Thank you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Well, thank you, Eric. I know this has been a work in process for many years, so we appreciate you bringing it back. And small business is important to us. Questions for Eric? Representative Gallegos.
Yeah, thank you. And I think the other day when we had testimony on the other companion bill from the NFIB, it's clear, you know, OECDD has been under some critical fire. You know, there's lots of bills out there that we're seeing the Trade and Economic Development Committee with respect to how OECDD should be organized, and should something happen to OECDD, which changes its structure and focus, what would happen to this small business, the Office of Small Business? I mean, is there another alternative place that this could go if something should happen? I mean, I'd just like to hear, like, Plan B.
Chairman Close, Representative Gallegos, obviously if you were to eliminate the Department of Economic and Community Development, this bill calls for the Small Business Advisory Committee and the process to be within that department. Well, whatever piece of legislation would presumably direct the state's efforts in economic development to some other state agency of some yet undetermined name could also include, obviously, a provision that would also transfer the responsibilities of the Small Business Council to that other agency. Obviously, at the moment, any legislation that we introduce has to be based on the current organization, state government, and that's the way this bill is predicated. But it would simply be a question of diverting it to whatever agency, and I'm assuming that regardless of what it's called, the state will have some agency dealing with economic development issues, and the Governor's Small Business Council should probably instead be a statutory advisory committee to that agency.
Other questions? Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Eric, the bill currently has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, but what I gathered from your testimony is that you're looking at this now being structured in such a way that it could be absorbed within the current budget and wouldn't require additional monies. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, yes, that would be correct. Obviously, it does give some additional authority for the agency to be involved in interacting with other state agencies and doing some things that probably are beyond their current activity level. But it also does not require any of those activities. As Representative Gallegos indicated, the direction of the Department of Economic and Community Development and the amount of funding that it's going to have available to provide services to the broad-based business community is still an unknown. My assumption is that they will come out of the session with pretty good support, because that department is really the one which is creating the economic engine which drives state revenue. So if we fail to do a good job of supporting that department, we won't be getting the kind of economy we need to get the tax revenue to fund all of the other public services. So my assumption would be that they will have the resources to be able to do that within their existing budget. What we tried not to do was to slice out a particular piece for small business activities, and I think that's something that needs to be left instead to the director, Marty Brantley, and to the legislature for any further guidance they give them through other committees.
Other questions? Representative Gerard.
Good morning, Eric.
I ask this question all the time because I enjoy getting a different answer every time. We have small business. We have big business. We don't seem to have any medium business. But where's the limit on small business? What's the definition of small business?
Kevin Close, Representative Garai. The definition in most state programs, that definition is a moderately small one, usually under 200. As you know, and as I testified on Monday, the federal definition is 500 employees. Oregon actually has a fair number of medium-sized businesses that are in that 50 to 200 or 250 range. But it also has a very, very large number of very small businesses, both micro-businesses, those that have only one to maybe three or four individuals involved in the business, one of which is usually an owner, and some of the others sometimes are even family members, and then a fairly large number of businesses in the 5 to 20 range. But most of the small businesses in Oregon are on the very small end of that 1 to 500 scale the federal government uses. And that's why perhaps having an Oregon definition of small business would be useful in statute.
Okay. Thank you very much, Eric. You've presented it very well for us.
Thank you.
We will call Ron Fox, who is from the department, OECDD. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, Chair Close and members of the committee. My name is Ron Fox. I'm the Manager of Business and Industry Programs with the Oregon Economic Community Development Department. And I want to sort of reinforce some of the comments that Eric Blackledge made in his opening comments about the proposed bill for an Office of Small Business. The department has been working very, very closely with the Governor's Small Business Council for a number of years on issues related to Oregon's assistance and support for small businesses, and I recognize Representative Garrard's definition of small to medium. I think the focus of the council has been toward the small side of that, but there's clearly department services that are directed at intermediate and as well as large firms. As Eric mentioned in his testimony, the department has had proposed a bill similar to this as a part of our department's proposal to the governor and his recommended balanced budget. That was not included. It did include a fiscal impact of staff additions. We feel that even as the bill is currently presented does have some fiscal impact in terms of the way the bill is written and the expectations that are provided in the particularly section one of the bill. We do provide the staff support to the Governor's Small Business Council, and as a result, we do incur some expenses related to that. But we feel there's a small fiscal impact associated with the expectations as presented in the legislation before you. But I want to be clear: we do support the initiative, the effort. We think it's a very important focus toward support and understanding of the needs and issues of Oregon's small businesses. So I guess I would be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Ron. I guess the biggest question is, in your judgment, is the fiscal on this below $50,000 that would require the referral to Ways and Means?
Our Chair Close, members of the committee, we've prepared what we believe is an appropriate fiscal impact statement and have included for the 2003-2005 biennium fiscal impact of $121,042. That represents part FTEs of a couple of people who would be necessary to implement some of the recommendations and the directions as set forth, particularly in Section 1 of the bill. For 2005-2007, which the bill has a implementation 90 days after the close of the session, so the 2005-2007 fiscal impact is $146,054.
And can you tell me in Section 1 specifically what these costs are arising out of? Which line of Section 1 are you referring to?
Madam Chair Close, members of the committee, particularly under Section 1, Item 1, it calls to serve small business by continuously evaluating the needs of small business and working with public and private entities. We've anticipated that to do that effectively, we need a mechanism to actually assess those needs and to be able to present those back to both the legislature, the governor, and other agencies in a format that can define and move forward solutions. There's also requirements that the department work directly with other state agencies in addressing their policies and procedures as they relate to their regulatory or other activities for small business. So we included those are the two principal ones that we see have some fiscal impact, not significant, but still there.
So, and maybe you said this, I'm sorry, but are you saying an additional FTE is needed, or would this be existing staff?
Chair, close members of the committee, we've, in our fiscal impact assessment, we have identified portions of full-time positions. It would either be reallocation of existing staff or additional staff that would be assigned some portion of this activity as a part of their responsibility.
Okay, so that's just to follow up one last time. The $121,000, can you just break down what those costs are briefly?
Yes, Chair, close members of the committee. $121,042 for the 03-05 biennium break out this way. $68,292 for personal services. That's staff and related expenses. We have included $52,750. For supplies and services. Included in that is funds that we believe would be necessary to conduct a validated and effective assessment survey of small business needs and how those needs are being met across the state. So that's
research, you're saying? Research?
Yeah, yes, research, survey analysis.
And are you submitting that to legislative fiscal?
Chair Close, we have submitted that to him for inclusion in the bill.
Okay. Other questions?
Madam Chair, just a comment that you made the comment that this would take effect 90 days after session, but there's actually no emergency clause or effective date in the bill. So I think unless a date is amended into it, it would really take effect January 1st under the way we operate now. So,
Chair McCloss, Representative Rosemont, I stand corrected. My numbers were really to calculate the delay in the 03-05 biennium.
Gotcha.
Other questions?
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2969, and I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2969. Representative Kitts.
Madam Chair, I would move that we refer House Bill 2969 to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Kitts moves House Bill 2969 to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
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 Aye. Votes aye. Motion carries. House Bill 2969 goes to the Committee on Ways and Means. Thank you very much. And we will close the work session on House Bill 2969. And I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 2 and have the staff read the summary.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 2 extends emergency unemployment benefits for up to 13 weeks. It applies to unemployed Oregonians who have exhausted their regular benefits, are not currently eligible for any other unemployment benefits, such as federal extensions, continue to meet normal eligibility requirements, and whose benefits expired after January 5, 2002. Senate Bill 2 prevents the Employment Department from charging an employer's account for being benefits paid under this bill and allows the director of the Oregon Employment Department to stop payments of emergency benefits when the total payments would exceed $29 million. The bill declares emergency takes effect upon passage. Members, you'll notice you have the fiscal impact statement for the bill in your packet.
Okay, thank you very much. And we will welcome the drafters of the bill, Senator Hannon and Senator Courtney, to the stand. Thank you for coming. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Close, members of the Business Labor and Consumer Affairs Committee here in the House. My name is Peter Courtney, and I live at 2925 Island View Drive North here in Salem. And I'm a state senator, and my district is District 11, which includes major portions of Salem. And then it runs up through Brooks and Jervis and Woodburn.
And may I interrupt you, sir? This is our Senate president. I want to make that clear. I forgot to say that. We're very honored to have you here.
Well, it's a high honor indeed for me, too, to be before your committee and for you, Representative Close, because Senate Bill 2, in effect, is really House Bill 4021. And, in effect, I must now acknowledge the presence of Representative Gallegos, Representative Kitts, and Representative Shawford, because House Bill 4021 came out of that first of 400,000 special sessions, it seems like, for me, starting back last year on February 8th. And this is, in effect, the same bill. And let me just, I'll get to that in a minute, but Oregon's economically, seasonally adjusted unemployment rate rose to 7.5% in January. And this state's economy has been unable to sustain any kind of significant employment growth during the past 10 months. The pace of recovery, especially in terms of new jobs being added, is painfully slow. And after some hopeful months in the spring of 2002, jobs gains petered out, and Oregon ended the year at essentially the same unemployment where it started. Now, you have my written testimony. Let me just put it this way to you. We passed the bill 4021 in that February 8th special session, because we had a February 8th, February 25th, June 6th, and then I just lose, my memory starts to fade after that. And what we tried to do back then was to provide unemployment insurance for those that were unemployed, some $29 million for or some 13 weeks, whichever came first. We did not implement that because the feds came in. In effect, the federal unemployment insurance has run out, and so we, Senator Hanna and I, thought we should introduce this bill again because we know that at least 1,900 people a month are exhausting their benefits, and we believe that somewhere in the neighborhood of 19,000 Oregonians have exhausted their benefits last year alone. We believe by taking $29 million, I'm told by the experts who are here in the room, that we will not affect unemployment insurance rates in terms of the private sector or individuals. The trust fund from Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund has $1.6 billion in it. We're simply asking to take $29 million at this time to go out and extend benefits to individual Oregonians for some 13 weeks. If I had my druthers, I wish it could be more, but when we push that point, I believe Senator Hannon in the Senate, for whatever reason, $29 million is the magic amount of money right now and all the 13 weeks. The beauty of this is it does allow individuals to have money to take care of those essential everyday needs they have. It also puts some money in the community, keeps it circulating. So it's a positive in terms of people who aren't working, but it's also a positive in terms of the private sector out there because we're all in this situation together. That's a quick summary, Representative Close, chair of this extraordinary committee of good people, high people. I just want to say, since I started my life where you are in terms of the House, I love the House. I revere the Senate. I got to say that because I'm sure the senators are watching this. But I do love the House, so it's always very sentimental for me to either come over here and walk around your House, the House four chambers, or to be before a House committee. So with that quick verbal statement, I believe you have with you, at least, I hope you have at least the formal official written document that I submitted for each of your. And with that, I'll either take your questions, comments, or criticisms now, or I would hope perhaps in deference to His Honor, who is the Dean and the Supreme of all legislators this time, since he's been here since B.C., the good senator from Atchison, my Republican colleague, be allowed to testify on Senate Bill 2.
Thank you, President Courtney. And we do welcome Senator Hannon, who is our Senate President Pro Tem, and so he is second in command in the Senate.
Thank you, Madam Chairperson and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Len Hannon, State Senator, District 3, which is Jackson County, and we have an unemployment rate of approximately 8.5% in our county that's substantially higher than the rest of the state. We share this belief, Senator Courtney and I, as well as many members of this legislature, that this is an issue that we looked at during one of the special sessions, And because the federal government stepped in and extended the 13 weeks additional benefit on the federal level, we did not enact our House bill. So what we're trying to do now is to try to create a situation where we provide this additional coverage for unemployed workers. I think it's important to understand the difficulty that workers are facing in our state. They survive from paycheck to paycheck, and this can make or break the difference of a lot of people in their daily lives. Having some additional funds, maybe it's not that much to a lot of people, but to people collecting unemployment benefits, it means the world. It means the difference. It means the difference of survivability and not. And so I appreciate the work of the committee and your support for this measure. I would, however, respectfully request that you strongly consider requesting the speaker maybe change the referral of this. I understand it has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. This bill has been under the scrutiny of Ways and Means previously in last year's special session, and this year the Legislative Fiscal Office has also been involved in the crafting of this bill. And as Senate President Courtney indicated, it does not jeopardize the rates for employers. It will not require an increase in the tax rate for employers in this state. And $29 million out of a $1 plus billion fund is adequate in which we can receive these additional compensations. So, Madam Chair, thank you for your courtesy and your willingness to consider this measure at this time.
Thank you, Senators, for bringing this bill. I want you to know I did vote for House Bill 4021 in the special session. I've received unemployment benefits myself, and I do believe this is a very important bill. Representative Kitts.
Senators Hannon and Courtney, first of all, thanks for coming here today and testifying on behalf of this. I can remember as a candidate for this very office reading the expose on Senator Courtney, you know, where he elaborated the relationship that the two of you have outside of the building. And I hope that one day as a young legislator to and I'm working on developing those very relationships with some of my friends on the other side of the aisle, where we can disagree in the building and meet for dinner and have great conversation. I think it's very important, and I thank you guys for that relationship. That being said, I would like to commend the way the Senate, the two senators, have conducted themselves with regards to this bill. It's an example for everybody, and I hope the Senate is watching right now, because I think the way that you guys have conducted yourselves on this bill shows statesmanlike behavior and behavior that all Oregonians expect from us as elected leaders. I will say that there's been partisan attacks to my chairwoman, that have been unfounded, ruthless, and uncalled for. I will not point fingers, but I will say that I hope that that was a one-time episode, and that we as a body can come together and learn from an example that is being shown by you. Everybody always says lead by example, and I thank you both for doing that. And whether I say it or show it, you guys are an example that I'm trying to follow in my everyday process. I'd like to thank my chair. She's had this bill for about 2 weeks, a lot less time than you guys had it on your side, and a lot less time than the federal government took to make their decisions. She's handled herself with grace, and I respect her, and I will support this bill enthusiastically because I think it's a good bill. And again, I thank you both.
Madam Chair, if I might speak on behalf of the Senate, being on the opposite side of the aisle from my good friend, the President, one of our members rose to apologize on the floor of the Senate to the Chair yesterday, publicly, to issue a public apology for the unfounded and untimely attacks verbal attacks upon the chairperson. And so I would say I appreciate your comments, Representative. They're certainly well taken. The good president and myself have tried to restore some civility to the process, and we want to maintain that civility. And we can't get there by exercising untimely comments towards each other. We can agree, we can disagree, but we can do so respectfully, not disrespectfully. And I appreciate your comments, and I will continue to share those comments with my colleagues in the Senate. So thank you for your admonition.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Representative Shoffman.
No, we've covered. Thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you, gentlemen, very much.
I'd like to say one thing, Chair Klobuchar, and again, thank you for your remarks. On a lighter side, I want you to know I do not have a relationship with Senator Hannan outside this building. We do not go to dinner. I don't want to go to dinner with him. And I just want to understand that. And we don't particularly like each other. So I just want to get that all out here, right here and now. So I have to say that. So I'm misbehaving a bit here. I just want to make that very clear right here and now. I want him
Senator
to stay in his
Corby,
office and I stay in mine as much as possible.
We recognize your wit and your legendary perspective in this building. And
if that were only true, Madam Chair.
Thank you so much. I feel like we should apply. Thanks for being with us. We have a number of people signed up to testify on this, and we are short on time. So the Oregon AFL-CIO has provided a number of people, and I think what we're going to do here is go to bring up their people. Larry Harmon, Michael Thomas, Patrick Thomas, because they've arranged this ahead of time. Please come forward. And we will have to ask that you keep your testimony to 2 minutes. Okay, I'm sorry. And Sandra Michaels, I overlooked her. If you could come up also, we have... can we bring in one more chair? Can you sign it in there? Could someone move that chair? All right. We've got one more chair coming here. You'll have to move your microphones back and forth. Good morning. Welcome. Go ahead.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Larry Harmon, and I'm an unemployed carpenter. I retired from the United States Army after 20 years of service and have been a carpenter in the commercial and industrial sector for the past 14 years. During this economic downturn that we are experiencing, I have watched my ability to make a living dry up. I come to you today to ask you to support Senate Bill 2, the extension of unemployment benefits. Without this extension, my ability to seek work will be greatly impaired. The amount of driving I do to seek work averages 250 miles a week. Coupled with the increased price of gasoline, greatly taxes my resources to be able to search for work. I am not in a situation as some of my co-workers who have lost or canceled auto insurance, sold vehicles, or most importantly, their tools, which is their ability to make a living, to make ends meet since their benefits have run out. But I have learned about the feelings of depression, which has caused me to lose my sense of worth, and have experienced firsthand the ugliness of age discrimination. If this extension does not pass, I will soon be there or will be forced to move out of the state of Oregon where I grew up and came back to after my military service. Oregon has always been a great state and my home. I came back because of that greatness. I hope that I do not have to leave because we cannot help one another. Thank you.
Thank you. And Patricia, right?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
You call me Patrick. I'm not a boy.
My name is Michael Thomas, and this is my wife, Patricia. Patricia and I were... we worked for AgriFrozen until April of 2001, and we, as the saying goes, been looking for work 99 and 44 100% of the time since, and we have not found it. Our unemployment claim has expired, and I have absolutely no idea or have any idea how we're going to meet our financial obligations this next month without a little bit of unemployment money to help us out. That's about all there is to it.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and the committee, Sandra Michaels, and I'm not just representing myself today, but also the Intel employees in Hillsboro. I belong to a Tuesday networking group, Intel networking group, and we meet and we've had help, the best help possible with Wright Management Consulting as a package that we had when we left Intel. And so many of us have had trouble finding jobs, and it's been a year or even longer than that that we've been seeking positions. And I'm a professional woman. I've never had a problem having a job in my life. This is so new to me. I'm a woman that took me 8 years to get my degree in business. I had two kids and was a single mom. I was on a fast track in government contracting, but left so I could get my master's in counseling. And I worked for 14 years at Boeing, and then I was just 1 year at Intel. And I've worked so hard. My career really has been my life, probably more so than it should have been. But I found work that I absolutely love to do in organization and people development and mediation. I've been very successful internally with Boeing and also at Intel with that. And last year I had to sell my house so I could live on the equity. And we're in unprecedented times now. I loved my house. I left Seattle to accept this position with Intel, and I found a house I just dearly loved, and it broke my heart, you know, to have to sell my home and to use the equity, and so I'm wondering how I'm ever going to be able to capture my losses again. And you go out there and you interview for a position, if you even are lucky enough to get to be interviewed, there's 100 or 200 people waiting. This is so different. You know, I want, and all the people that I know, want to come to work just like you come to work every day. We want a job, we want to feel valuable, and that we're contributing. The last thing we want to do is have to live off unemployment. But believe me, when you don't have much of a choice, it is a blessing to keep us going. It helps so much. So what we really need to do is, Oregon is a state. How are we going to have more jobs coming to this state? I don't want to leave. I love Portland now. I thought I loved Seattle, but Portland is a wonderful place to live. So help. Whatever you can do, it would be greatly appreciated.
Thank you very much. And we're out of time on this panel. We appreciate it. I'm going to call Leo Vallejo, excuse me. Victoria Lowe, John Stevens, Mike Edom, whichever it is. And please go ahead. Whoever wants to go. Okay, why don't we go to the other people first then? Victoria Lowe.
Yes, I'm Victoria Lowe from Forest Grove. Oregonian, native Oregonian, who's been employed for 35 years, not all in one place. Went to work for Intel 2 years ago and was subject to a layoff of 4,000 people. I've applied for over 100 positions. I've had 5 interviews, and in those interviews I've been told that there were 150 to 250 applicants. So I'm the same as previous testifiers. I've never had a problem getting a job. Usually if I get an interview, I have the job. So I'm hoping that you will pass this so we can have extra benefits to get us that distance to hopefully get through the layoffs that are continuing. And I am also concerned about the continual layoffs and what we will do as a state to bring more employment into the state. Thank you.
Thank you. John Stevens.
Hello, my name is John Stevens. I'm a software engineer. I've been at Intel for 18 and a half years.
I have a bachelor's degree in psychology, an associate's degree in electronics, and a bachelor's degree in software engineering technology from OIT. I've been training the whole time I've been in my 18 and a half years. I consider myself to be a very skilled individual in software. I've applied for jobs. I've had a few interviews. But I have not received enough opportunity for employment yet. I've been in a number of group support groups where I've looked around the rooms and I've known the individuals from my years at Intel. And these are very talented people who are now unemployed. These are people who have very skilled that they've developed over the years. I want you to understand that the people who are unemployed in the area of high tech are experiencing something that's new for them in their lives. I hear a number of them have said that they've never really experienced unemployment in the past. I heard stories about people who applied to five positions and they end up getting seven or eight job opportunities. This has changed. This is a big deal for the software industry in Portland. So I appreciate the unemployment compensation I'm receiving now. It's kept my family stable. It's made me quite a bridge for me in this time. And hopefully by the time that I come off unemployment, there will be opportunities for me. Thank you.
Thank you. Mike Edom.
Madam Chair, my name is Mike Edom. Lived here in Oregon all my life. I'm a member of the Carpenters Local 2130 in Hillsboro. For the past number of years, I've been involved in high-tech construction, specifically at Intel and LSI, as a construction manager for one of the largest construction firms in Oregon. I've been in contact with my boss on a regular basis. I'm ready to go back to work. There's just no jobs. They aren't getting the jobs. And specifically the high-tech stuff. I mean, this was supposed to be the savior of our state after we, you know, turned away from the timber industry. And now it's just, it's gone away. My unemployment benefits ran out in August. I've been living on my savings and doing some odd jobs with my local. But it's just one or two days and that's it. My savings is gone. And, you know, I like every other veteran who came back from the war, I just bought a new house and, you know, I'm going to lose it if we don't get some jobs here. And I ask you and I urge you to pass this and not send it to another committee, to just pass this bill. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. And that we will go to the interpreter now. You're allowed 2 minutes, so you're going to have to get your interpretation in. We have about six more. We have about four more. They are lobbyists, so we probably will ask for written testimony from the lobby. Go ahead.
Señor representantes, mi nombre es Leodegario Vallejo.
Representatives, my name is Leodegario Vallejo.
Estoy aquí para exponer mi situación y la de muchos de mis compañeros.
I'm here to talk about my situation and that of many of my colleagues and coworkers.
A nuestra historia se concentra en la planta de hongos.
Our story is the story of the mushroom plant.
Hay compañeros que trabajaron durante décadas en la planta.
There are my coworkers that worked for decades in that plant.
Al cerrarse, aproximadamente 340 personas nos quedamos sin empleo.
When it closed, about 340 of us were without work.
Unas 200 personas acudimos al beneficio de desempleo.
About 200 of us applied for unemployment.
Desde luego buscando ayuda económica.
Of course we needed that economic support.
Razón por la que tuvimos la oportunidad de asistir a las clases de inglés.
And we were also given the opportunity to study English.
Clases para el GED.
GED classes.
En los salones de Chemecra.
At the classes at Chemecra.
Con el apoyo de estos beneficios.
With the support of these benefits.
Fue posible aprovechar unos términos de diferentes clases en donde muchos compañeros han sabido aprovechar.
We've been able to learn different subjects and improve ourselves.
Obteniendo sus diplomas de GED.
Some of us have gotten GED diplomas.
Y otros que llevan más materias presentadas.
Others are in other subject matters.
Y otros que están a punto de empezar con estas clases en otros exámenes.
And some of us are again ready to start another term of classes.
Para nosotros es muy importante la aprobación de la ley SB2.
So for us it's very important that you approve SB2.
Thank you very much. Your time is up.
Thank you.
Eduardo Angulo, excuse me. Roger K, please come forward. Good morning.
Good morning, Chair Close, members of the committee, House Business Labor and Consumer Affairs Committee. My name is Roger Kay. I reside at 10095 Parish Gap Road, Southeast in Turner. I'm one of those unfortunate people in Oregon unemployed as a result of the attacks of 9/11. I've exhausted my federal and state regular and extended unemployment benefits. SB2 has been passed by the Senate to provide an additional benefit to those of us seeking work in a very bad recessionary environment. I read in the Statesman Journal that there are more than 18,000 Oregonians who have also exhausted their benefits. The funding has already been set aside this last year from reserves provided by employer contributions, and therefore there is not additional fiscal impact to the general fund. I, along with many other unfortunate Oregonians, would be very grateful to you for passing this bill out of your committee today and sending it with a due pass recommendation to the House floor. I think the governor will sign this to provide immediate needed additional help to those out of work.
Thank you very much. For other questions, he has how much time? Okay. And was Eduardo here? He apparently had to leave. Good morning.
Good morning,
You have 2 minutes.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Eduardo Angulo. I am the chairman of the Salem Kaiser Coalition for Equality. I am here today in support of this bill. I think that it is important to acknowledge that there are thousands of workers out there dislocated that need the support of our legislators, that need the support of all of us. And I want to encourage your entire committee to please support extending the benefits for all this work.
Thank you very much. We have 50 seconds. Questions? Okay, thank you. All right, our last group is our lobby, Tim Nesbitt, Lynn Lundquist, Bob Castonia, Philip Kennedy Wong. I'm going to call you all forward, and we have had extensive testimony, gentlemen. If you do intend to move the bill, if you could make your remarks very brief, I would appreciate it.
Thank you, Chair Close, members of the committee. Tim Nesbitt for the Oregon AFL-CIO. Appreciate your acting on the bill today. I have submitted written testimony. I'll leave it at that, and I just want to call your attention to the fact that not only do we have more than 150,000 unemployed Oregonians officially right now, we have a projection from the state economist that we're not going to achieve levels of employment that we had 2 years ago until next year sometime. So the needs are quite compelling. I think the prior testimony was more eloquent than mine could possibly be, and we urge prompt action on the bill. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Tim, for giving us this list. It's been very helpful.
Thank you, Chair Close. For the record, Bob Castagna, Oregon Catholic Conference. I want to thank the Chair for expediting the hearing on this bill. It was as a result of listening to the testimony in the Senate that it came to my attention that the effect of the bill that you passed during the first special session in 2002 had not flowed to workers in terms of extended state unemployment insurance benefits. It was with that knowledge, then, that I went to the Senate leadership and to the chair of the Senate committee and asked them to expedite the process, suspending the rules along the way. And I make a similar request of you today. based upon the testimony that you have heard from unemployed workers, I make a request to the chair and the leadership of the House to suspend the rules and get this bill on the floor and to the governor's desk as quickly as possible. I also ask that you keep attention to this issue as we approach the May revenue forecast and the projections of unemployment. It is my understanding from conferring with officials from the Employment Department that by the end of the first week in September, there is the possibility, given the convergence of federal and state law and projections in unemployment, that we may exhaust all extended unemployment benefits by the end of the first week in September, which may occasion the necessity for this legislature by the second, third week in May to revisit this issue to see if there are additional funds in the trust fund which could be used to extend those benefits. I think it would be a travesty if you left here in June, July, or August, or whenever this legislature adjourns, only to have all extension of unemployment insurance benefits be exhausted by the end of the first week in September, and there be no extension of unemployment insurance benefits. Our interest in a church is securing the safety net and not having the disruption in people's lives unnecessarily complicate their lives during periods of unemployment. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And Peter. Excuse me, Philip.
It happens all the time. My brother is actually named Peter. For the record, my name is Phil Kennedy, along with Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon. Share close to members of the committee. Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon is an association of 17 Christian denominations. We're here in support of Senate Bill 2. And rather than go into sort of like the litany of numbers, I'm going to take my a few seconds to talk about the impact in terms of what we do as we deal with some of the symptoms of unemployment. We run a small food emergency program in Northeast Portland called the Northeast Emergency Food Program, which it's housed out of a small Lutheran church. And the reason why I bring this example is that it is an example of other faith-based social services that are dealing with the symptoms of unemployment. It's a program that we run. We only operate it 2 hours a day, but yet it takes 4 volunteers to keep it going and a half-time staff person. And we've been overwhelmed by the number of people requesting for food. And we see both people who are unemployed and people who are working, but working very low wages and are unable to keep up with the cost of living. So with that, I want you to just leave that example with you to keep in mind that the passage of this bill would go a long ways to helping address some of the people who are looking for food services and other emergency needs. Thank you for your support.
Thank you very much. And is Mr. Lundquist in the room?
He had
to be. Okay. All right, committee, we are waiting for Representative Barker, who has also asked time to speak. Is he on his way? Okay. We're going to wait just a minute to see if Representative Barker shows up, and then we will intend to go into work session. We will stand again. Please don't leave the room, committee. Appreciate you bearing with us.
Well, thank you very much, Madam Chair, and I appreciate you allowing me the time to come in here real quick. My purpose today is twofold. First, I want to offer my sincere thanks to the Chair for arranging this expedited consideration of Senate Bill 2. I know that your committee is very busy and has many, many very important bills to consider, so thank you again for your consideration in this matter. Second, I want to urge the committee's approval of Senate Bill 2. As you know, the bill received a unanimous vote in the Senate with strong support from both Democrats and Republicans. The money for the extension of unemployment insurance is already in place on deposit in the Unemployment Insurance Fund. All we need now is to pass Senate Bill 2 and get that extra 13 weeks of coverage out to the unemployed Oregonians who really need it. The faster we act, the more we reduce their hardship. This action will enable thousands of families to stay afloat while the breadwinners continue their search for jobs. In short, we will keep thousands of good, solid citizens from slipping through the cracks. This is a good cause, something Republicans and Democrats can agree on. I know that many Oregonians who live in my district will be grateful for the action you take today. And again, thank you, Madam Chair, for giving me this opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Representative Barker.
Thank you.
I'm closing the public hearing on Senate Bill 2. And we appreciate everyone who's come and sharing your stories. It's been very helpful to us.
and we wish you the very best in seeking and getting employment. I'm opening a work session on Senate Bill 2, and Representative Garrard, you have a motion.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 2 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded.
Representative Garrard has moved Senate Bill 2 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the subsequent referral on the bill be rescinded. Is there discussion? Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that Senate Bill 2 is probably the single most important bill that we are going to have this session in this committee, and I really appreciate Senators Courtney and Hannon for bringing it forward. But what I really wanted to say today was to thank you as the chair of this committee for holding this hearing, for doing so expeditiously and professionally. And I personally do want to apologize for the remarks that have been made over the last week or so on the floor, which I do think were inappropriate. And sometimes I think in people's zeal to see something happen or their political energy, they make comments that do go beyond what I think is acceptable. And I would just say to you today that I think this is an issue that you've handled well and appropriately. And I also really want to thank the workers that came forward today to tell their stories. I know that there are thousands of people out there with stories like the ones that you have told us. It's an extremely scary time in our state. I think a time that none of us has ever seen a situation this bad across the spectrum of professions and ages of people who are out there looking for jobs, and there just are not jobs to be had. So this is certainly little enough that we can do, but something we can do that I think will help potentially 18,000 people who have exhausted their benefits. And so I'm very pleased to be able to support the bill today.
Thank you very much. And Representative Merkley, briefly, please. We have session coming.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. I'd also like to thank folks for testifying and giving us a personal perspective. And the Chair, your efforts to go and lift the subsequent referral to Ways and Means, I think, are appreciated by everyone here in this room today and those thousands of workers beyond who aren't here, but for whom these extended benefits will greatly facilitate the transition, hopefully, to the next job in their life. Thank you.
Thank you. Other comments? Representative Kitts, briefly, please.
Very briefly. I have to take notion with what Representative Rosenbaum said. I hope that this is not the most important bill that comes out. While it is important, I hope that the jobs bill, that hopefully this committee is going to work bipartisan in a bipartisan fashion to create jobs so that we don't have to beg and plead and scrape for every nickel and dime for these folks out here. I hope we can create some jobs, and I think that would be the most important. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Kitts. We have many important bills. I'm sure we will all disagree on which ones are the most important. Seeing no further comments, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Evans?
Aye.
Representative
Gerard? Aye.
Representative
Merkley?
Aye.
Representative
Joplin? Aye.
Representative Kitts?
Aye.
Representative
Rosenbaum? Aye. Chair Close? Both aye. Motion carries. Senate Bill 2 has passed to the floor. Close the work session. And we will have co-carriers of Representative Rosenbaum and myself. And nothing else, we are adjourned.